Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the second attempt to do this stream. There was some sort of technical error before. Sorry about that. So, okay, just to reiterate what I said before, I'm now here with Duncan Smith, and he's written a book which I think will be of interest to many people in this sphere. So this stream is effectively an advert for that book, and I thought that's fair enough because I think it will be something that's interesting to people. So the book is called Conquest by Concept, and we'll be talking about that, but first we're going to be talking about I'll introduce you to the author, and we'll discuss some of the topics. So Duncan, please introduce yourself to the audience.
Sure, Rose. Well, my name is Duncan Smith. I'm an Australian writer, and as I said before, one of the few who's not aligned with the progressive left. So I'm one of the small minority who is prepared to criticise the leftist ideas and talk about topics which they might consider taboo. And I think we really need to have more diversity of views in the creative world. As I think you said to John Waters and a couple of your other guests last week, that the vast majority of cultural creation is heavily aligned to the progressive left. It's almost mandatory. And if you don't do that, you run the risk of cancel culture.
But absolutely. It's extremely narrow-minded, and the result is a rather boring cultural landscape. I mean, I feel like art and drama, fiction nowadays doesn't really relate to the real world because it can't. It can't address head-on the issues in the modern world. It's not allowed to. So,
if you walk into a bookshop these days, 90% of the books with any political content will automatically be leftist, and that's fiction or non-fiction. So I think we really need to get away from that. It becomes very boring, as you said.
Boring and unfulfilling, but also unintelligent, unreflective. It's not doing what art should do. So to get back to what we were saying before, how did you leave the left?
Well, as I said, I got slightly irritated with feminism, which is very easy to do, and I wrote an essay about male privilege, or so-called male privilege, and that turned into a book, which was called The Vast and the Spurious, which was a detailed critique of feminism. And at the same time, I was getting into YouTube, the golden age of YouTube before the censorship. And so there were a lot of great thinkers on there, like Jared Taylor, Karen Strawn, yourself, Stefan Molyneux, and I inevitably became more and more to the right. And this came out in my work, my written work, particularly in the new book, Conquest by Concept, which is specifically about the culture war and particularly the events of the last 4 years since the 2016 election.
Okay, so we'll get straight on to that. First of all, before we get into the book itself, what are some topics that are of specific interest to you? I'm guessing feminism is one of them.
Well, that's one, certainly. Yeah. But probably one of the main topics is critical race theory, which is all the rage in 2020, so-called whiteness studies, white fragility, and so on. That's the centerpiece of the book. When the three main characters go to a workshop in whiteness studies. And this is quite a comical event, as it turns out. But in the aftermath of that, one of the main characters, who is the representative of the dissident right, he goes through a very detailed breakdown of the event and the views of the speaker. And at the same time, the other character that goes with to the event is a leftist, and she has a very different reaction. So apart from that, I talk about the media bias, the constant coercion that we are given to think and believe a certain way. This, of course, within education, the media, Hollywood, and so on. And a lot of incidental topics come up. Trump derangement syndrome, of course, and Antifa is there's a whole chapter on Antifa towards the end of the book. and the sort of thinking that goes into that mindset. So really, there's a great deal, a wide range of topics from the last 4 years, which most people will recognize.
So you mentioned to start with critical race theory. This might seem a strange question, but would you define critical race theory for people?
Well, it's an academic theory of racism, which has been within the academy for quite a while, but which has come out into the mainstream this year, particularly following the death of George Floyd and everything that happened from that. But and you now have people like Robin DiAngelo, for example, who's wrote a book called White Fragility, and she's apparently charging $10,000 a night to inform people of this theory. It's basically a theory which is obsessed with race and racism and insists on interpreting all social interactions in terms of race. And this, there might be some excuse for it if it was an even-handed treatment of the topic, but it's heavily biased towards minorities, if I can use that term, non-whites. It's obviously very anti-white. And so it's an obsession with seeing racism as at the core of society, and it equates whiteness, if I can use that term, as the source of structural inequality and discrimination. So apparently we're in the grip of white supremacy and systemic racism, and this is a very unproductive way to think, really, for everyone, because for
it's very resentful.
Well, it's heavily resentful. It's totally based on resentment and the scapegoating of one group, one racial group. And I think, as there's a quote from Jim Goad, I think he said, "If you can't say anything positive about whites and you can't say anything negative about blacks, well, let's stop pretending this is anything to do with equality and objectivity." It's a heavily agenda-based ideology which attributes all social problems to history and the great sins of Western civilization, and it's really hard to take seriously once you look into it closely.
I remember seeing about a year ago, and maybe longer than that, man, maybe 2 years ago, there was a Tucker Carlson clip where he was interviewing this guy, and it was hilarious because the guy was droning on about this kind of thing, structural racism, white privilege and all that. And Tucker Carlson said to the guy, "Well, you're critiquing white culture. You're saying negative things about white culture. Will you say a negative thing about any non-white culture?" The guide simply refused to make any negative comment about any culture that wasn't white. He couldn't do it. He couldn't bring himself to do it because that would be such a violation of his doctrine, which espouses equality, but is completely uninterested in equality.
Well, it's interesting that white culture is the only one that you're permitted to criticize. I can't think of a single other culture that draws criticism and that would not be censured if there was such criticism. So apparently this is white privilege that you're the only culture that is allowed to be blamed or criticized.
Absolutely. I'm guessing that you have experienced in real life this thing about leftists trying to wrangle with this, and you've definitely written it into the book. So I'm guessing that you've seen it in some way in real life, where leftists are confronted with the fact that they are encouraged to be racist against white people and against white culture, but they somehow managed to delude themselves about this.
Well, certainly a pivotal scene in the book is that the main character, who is a bit of a blue pill normie, he's dragged along to an Antifa protest, and he's mistaken for one of the right-wing people attending the event, and is racially abused for being white by other Antifa. So I can't say I've directly experienced it myself, but it's inescapable nowadays in the media, social media, and you know, it's inescapable. I mean, 10 years ago, I had no real interest in the topic of race, but it just seems to be in our face all the time. So if they insist we talk about it, well, that's what I've decided to do.
Yeah, so, and this is a sort of volley in the culture war. I mean, it's the subtitle of the book is A Novel About the Culture War, but presumably it's also intended to be part of the culture war itself.
Well, certainly, yes. It should certainly have some kind of effect if it has readers. And I can't say it's subjective. It's from our perspective. But I don't totally ignore the other side as well. I do give a voice to the progressive left and through the characters, particularly, really, it's about three characters mainly. And the guy telling the story is a blue pill guy. His name is John. And unfortunately for him, he has a girlfriend named Angie who's a far left. So she represents the far left. She's a radical feminist. She's an Antifa. She's never met a progressive cause she didn't like. And then on the other hand, you have this third character, a guy named Edward Hall, who represents the dissident right. Now, through circumstances, the normie guy, John, he meets Edward Hall. And this guy starts to get in his ear and make him question the politics he's accepted without much thought. And he slowly starts to red pill John through the course of the book. And this produces a lot of conflict, which is good for a novelist, of course, because drama is driven by conflict, as probably comedy as well. And so the rest of the book, this guy John is drawn between the far left with his girlfriend Angie. He's got to keep in good with her. And also this member of the dissident right who's pulling him towards the right. So it plays out over a number of themes and events like that.
I can imagine that there must be a bit of a challenge to not make the characters just ciphers representing political doctrines. But at the same time, because this has never, I mean, this does seem like quite an original work. I don't think there's actually been something like this done before. So I guess it doesn't really matter that much, even if they are just ciphers, because it's still such an unusual thing to do.
Well, yeah, that's right. I'm not aware of another book that's so directly about the culture war. There may be some, but I haven't heard of any as yet. And there is the risk you can end up strawmanning people, particularly people you don't really like. But then again, you know, reality is almost a straw man in itself. If you look at standard some leftists, you know, it's almost is a straw man in itself without having to exaggerate anything. And so, for example, the person giving the whiteness presentation, it is based on real people. And if you go back to the original text or the source, there's really not much difference between the way I've depicted them and their actual words and the beliefs. And as for the girlfriend, Angie, well, I'm sure we've seen plenty of people like her that, you know, that seem...
Well, I mean, but, almost any... Is she white?
Oh, yeah, she's white, of course.
Yeah. So almost any white girl who's been to university or is at university today will be saturated with leftism and with cultural Marxism. That's just, it's part of the machine. You know, university is now a machine for doing that to young Western people, and especially white people, actually, because they're the ones who have to be weakened.
Well, certainly, and this girl, this character, Angie, comes from that whole environment. Her father is actually an academic. And she is totally steeped in this ideology from a young age. And I will say that, you know, there is a surprise in the plot, in her character arc. Towards the end of the book, she takes an unexpected detour as a result of a little faux pas she makes on social media. And so she does undergo a few changes by the end of the book.
Sorry, I've been muting while you were talking. And is that a painful process for her?
Oh, certainly. It's quite traumatic.
Right.
And, you know, this is not uncommon. If you look at cancel culture today, and many staunch leftists have gone through this. J.K. Rowling, I think, for example, said something about transgenderism, and she incurred the wrath of people on Twitter and Facebook. One of her books was, or all her books were, banned from some bookshops in Australia, I believe.
That's incredible. I mean, she was such a sort of staunch, like a staple of champagne socialism, and then she failed the test herself. I mean, it's incredible. Is that something that is alluded to in the book? The fact that leftism seems to be in a purity spiral, where it's churning out people who are ever more ideologically pure and brittle.
Oh yeah, certainly, and there is a great risk in the for the white leftists themselves as they treading this dangerous ground. I mean, you might be a white feminist, and if you make a racial faux pas, for example, then you will find a lot of karma coming your way, and you will find a lot of backlash coming to you that you have given out for years against, say, white men. You'll find that coming back in spades if you make a racial faux pas and to get on the wrong side of these people. And there is something similar does happen in the book. So I've certainly woven that very much into the plot.
Because it does seem that you're going to university used to be, you know, it was supposedly about learning different ideas and becoming exposed to lots of different ideas, and really just being, it's like a buffet of different perspectives. But of course, now it's absolutely not like that. I don't think it's been like that for 20 years or probably a lot more than that, to be honest. But certainly I can't imagine how biased it must be now. Like in the last 5 years, I just cannot, it must be hellish.
Well, you know, if I had a kid of university age, I would not want them to go to university now. I did go to university 20 years ago, and it was okay then. I managed to avoid most of, this sort of thing. But it's interesting, I got into an argument on Twitter a while ago with an academic. And in Australia, we had some funding cuts to the arts degrees. So the government made the arts degrees more expensive or whatever. So there was a lot of talk about, well, what use is an arts degree anyway? And so people were saying that, it teaches critical thinking, it teaches you to think. And so I was talking to this academic and I said, well, can you name me one academic who has come out with any critical perspective on the Black Lives Matter movement, for example? This was in about July at the height of the George Floyd aftermath. This guy could not link me to a single academic that has any critical perspective on Black Lives Matter whatsoever. And I thought this is quite typical. There is this complete totalitarian conformity of thought, which is, when I went to uni, they teach you how to think, but now I think they just teach you what to think. And that's a big difference.
Yeah, and it's amazing also that these people don't realise this about their own, about themselves and about their own situation. You'd think that they would have their self-reflection to see, my God, I haven't actually taken alternative ideas seriously for 25 years. But it doesn't ever seem to occur to them, or if it does, it doesn't worry them. I think it's become, well, I know it's a cliche to say this, but it has become like a religion at this point, where it would be dangerous to question it. I think the believers of it think it's right that I haven't considered alternative ideas, because the alternative ideas can only, by definition, be evil.
Well, exactly, and that's what this academic said. I said, can you present me any sort of critique of Black Lives Matter? And this guy said, oh, well, that would, by definition, be a racist. And I said, no, not necessarily. Just give me a critique of Black Lives Matter it doesn't have to be racist, just give me your thoughts. And for him, this was inseparable. You could not criticize anything about Black Lives Matter without being a racist, which was ludicrous, of course. But it's been a long time since. I mean, they're not allowed to. That's the bottom line. They're not allowed to consider taboo ideas, or they would soon lose their jobs. There have been plenty of cases where academics have lost their jobs for quite innocuous things. Things that we would consider fairly mild and, nothing too bad. Well, that's enough to get you cancelled and lose their job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. And you can understand why, they don't question their beliefs. Because on the one hand, you've got the true believers, the sort of incurious people who are just, or religiously minded people who are effectively indoctrinated with this stuff. But then you've got the others who, a small minority, maybe 10-20%, who I think will be curious, but they will know, I can't afford to look into this, because if I just I might well discover that all of this is a load of rubbish, and everything that I see and hear from other from my colleagues is all rubbish, and I can't afford to hear that and to then accept that, because then I will be a pariah, and then I would have to live my life pretending. And so it's easier if I just continue believing.
Well, that's right. And this is the success of how the totalitarian systems operate. They begin by censoring you, and then eventually they get to the point where you're self-censoring and you're self-brainwashing into the accepted beliefs. And so, that's how it happens. And that's how cults work. That's how totalitarian systems work. So I don't see how an academic could really go otherwise and depart from it. I did read one letter from an academic, who was critical of Black Lives Matter, but he had to do it anonymously. And I believe he wasn't even white. I think he was an Asian academic. And he put out an anonymous letter, but the fact that it had to be anonymous tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, indeed, it's incredible, and I can only imagine that's among the staff. But to be a student at university now, it must be. I mean, it was bad enough when I was at art college. There was one guy who was a conservative, and everyone he wasn't hated, but everyone thought he was a bit of a dick for being a conservative. To be anything, I don't know. It's difficult to put myself in the position of if I were 20 years younger and I was, if I were going to university now or art college now, I imagine I would be pretty up for the leftist thing, I'm guessing, because I was then. So presumably now it would be even easier to just assume that that is the truth. But I don't know. And anyway, I do think that, even 20 years ago, we made fun of the concern of the Tory boy. I think that in university now, it must be much more. It's not like they would treat you as a bit of a clown and have a laugh with you while still, talking to you. I think nowadays you'd be basically setting yourself up to be a complete, to get expelled.
You would be a complete pariah. There's no doubt about it. I'm sure it's far worse than it was. There's no question I don't think you could really survive as a right-wing student these days. You would be expelled. I mean, why would you want to be there anyway? But I must admit, when you are in the company of leftists, you feel this pressure to go along with their beliefs. It almost feels like some gravity pushing down on you. You feel that you want to go along with it just to keep the peace, and you want to censor yourself and keep your thoughts to yourself. So it's not the way universities are supposed to be, certainly.
No, absolutely not. So are the characters in the book, are they students or are they postgrads or what?
Two of them are students. One of them, the normie guy, is a student. He's studying to become a teacher, a school teacher. This comes into the plot when he goes into a high school to do a practical placement. and this is where the anti-feminism theme comes in. He encounters the the feminist takeover of education, the anti-male bias in the system. And so he experiences that directly. His girlfriend, of course, she is a student. She's studying arts law or something. And the other guy, the dissident right guy, he's a former academic. So he's a guy who got away. And so, you know, they're all connected to education one way and another. And the way what it is the at one point in the story, this the blue pill guy, John, he has been red pilled by Edward Hall, the right wing guy, but he finds it's all too much. And so he wants to go back to the blue pill. He wants to get back to the way he was for the sake of a quiet life. And so that's exactly what he does. But at that point, he goes into the school system to train as a teacher. And then he just notices all the anti-male stuff, the anti-Western, anti-white stuff, which is seeped into the curriculum. And he holds out for a while, but eventually it's too much, and he stages his own little revolution. But yeah, they're all connected with education, and it's certainly part of the plot.
Without endangering yourself in any way, what research did you do for this book?
Well, I did a bit of school teaching myself, a bit of, as a placement. My research has been just fairly wide on all these topics, all the topics I've mentioned. And I make a point of listening to the opposition as well, because you've got to get out of your echo chamber. You can't just listen to people who agree with you. So you've got to listen to the opposition and try to understand them. When I read the feminism book, I read a lot of feminist literature, a lot of books, as well as the MRA stuff. And with the critical race theory, well, naturally, I have to read the source material, someone like Robin DiAngelo, for example. I listened to her talks on YouTube.
Was that enjoyable?
It was very difficult, extremely difficult, but it was something I had to do. So
I remember watching this lecture by a woman back in 2014, 15, right at the start of my channel. I think it was 2014. And I did this video about it. I watched this lecture by this woman, and it was so difficult and so maddening to watch, because I realized that basically every single thing she was saying was destructive. Every single sentence was attacking and deconstructing and discrediting something about the West, everything. And it was just like watching a blind black person just shooting blindly. They didn't even know what they were doing, really. It's just that they were programmed to do it, and they couldn't imagine any other way of being.
Well, that's right. And I really feel sorry for the people that who only get that side, and they only get that point of view, and they're completely denied criticism. And if that's all you consumed, if you heard that sort of reading material in those lectures, well, of course you're going to go along with it. What can you do? But that's why the YouTube stuff in the golden age was so refreshing, because you did get that point of view, which, I mean, I went along with leftism for a while, and you used to have this nagging sense there's something wrong with it, but you can't quite put your finger on it always until someone can point it out to you. So that's why the alternative media was so important. And that's probably the most disturbing thing for me in the last 2 years is the censorship, where the alternative voices are really being, deplatformed and slowly hidden away and censored. And so now you're not getting that counterbalancing point of view, which can, give you an alternative to this terrible sort of ideology that people are being given.
Well, on that note, I hope that everyone enjoys watching the Jordan Peterson videos that are linked after this stream. And apparently after every one of my videos, it's a sea of Jordan Peterson clips that people are recommended. I mean, that's why I'm still allowed on YouTube. I'm essentially being used as a gateway to Jordan Peterson.
Well, I think the Jordan Peterson interview with Kathy Newman, I think it was, that was a real hit and got through to the mainstream. I think even some mainstream people who hear nothing but mainstream media actually saw that interview, and it did make an have an effect.
But it's interesting that he, and I agree, but it is interesting that they now use him as like the absolute limit. You know, this is that Jordan, they're prepared to have Jordan Peterson clips all over YouTube, and that is what people are directed to. If they're watching anything more dodgy or less, you know, ideal, then they're directed towards that, and that's what they want as the absolute limit of acceptable rebellious thought. But that's another matter. I don't want to get too much into that. One thing I would ask you, you've got three main characters in this novel, a left-wing girl, a right-wing male student, and a normie male student, and a right-wing male lecturer or former
academic, yes.
Former academic. Without giving away the plot, and I don't want to, you know, ruin the novel for anyone, but what would you say about the arc for each of these characters? How does each of them change throughout the course of the story? With the if we take the female leftist first.
Well, certainly the female leftist is she's as far left as you want to begin with, and continues that way most of the book. And you would expect her to remain that way. However, in the last section of the book, she does have a rude awakening when she comes up against the limitations of that way of thought, and she gets a little bit of blowback on the way she's been treating other people when it comes back on her. So she's probably the most surprising character arc, and I don't want to give away the plot too much, but that's probably the most surprising development in the book. As for the normie guy, well, he is like a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets back with the girl. He starts off as a normie, and then he slowly gets red-pilled by this third character, and that goes on for about half the book, and halfway through the book, there's a climactic event for him. It's to do with refugees. And he comes up against some events that disturb him, and then he wants to go back to the blue pill. Now, this is motivated by for his own personal reasons as well. He wants to keep in good with Angie, his girlfriend. And so he makes a deliberate effort to reject the right-wing guy. He goes back to the blue pill. And he says as much. So he deliberately tries to go back to the blue pill, and he keeps it up for a few chapters in the next section of the book. And then eventually reality hits him with the second wave of red pilling. So inevitably he has to go back to the red pill after that. That's from his school teaching experience. As for the dissident right guy, well, he doesn't really change throughout the book. He is the constant. But if you're looking at a backstory, you know, some kind of a prequel, well, he would have had his own red pill experience before that. But for this particular novel, no, he's just a constant.
Right, okay. What would you say, apart from being a tonic for people, would you say that this book is educational?
Oh, absolutely. It's very educational. It's also quite amusing. There's a lot of humour in the book. I always have a lot of humour in my books, and I think anyone that has been watching these events of the last few years, probably the last 5 or 6 years, will certainly recognise a lot of things that come up in it, and some familiar characters as well. I mean, if you look at the initial red pill event in the plot, what happens is the normie guy gets dragged along to an Antifa protest by his girlfriend. And what they're doing, they're going to protest a speaking tour by Stephen Molyneux and Lauren Southern. This is based on a real event that happened a couple of years ago. I think it was 2018. Stephen Molyneux and Lauren Southern came to Australia. They were meant to go to New Zealand, but Jacinda Ardern didn't let them in. She was too worried about their hate speech. But they did make it to Australia. So that was a real event that I attended, actually, and I've woven this into the plot. And so this is when the normie guy goes along to the Antifa protest to protest Stephen Molyneux. And what happens is he gets separated from Angie, the girlfriend. And then he gets caught up in the crowd, and there's a few like sort of brawls and aggro going on. And he gets into a fight with some of the Antifa people, an actual fight. And this is how he meets the right-wing guy, Edward Hall, because he, through a funny chain of events, that's how he gets together with the guy, and that's how he first starts talking to the right-wing guy. And I'm sure this is a common experience, but it turns out this guy had no real idea what the right-wing guy was like. He had a completely false idea. He was some kind of fascist and racist and what have you, and it's quite amusing, you know, the way it plays out in the scene.
Right. Is this a book that you would recommend people get for their liberal friends, their progressive friends?
I would. Well, they can. What I'd say is they should read it for themselves, and then maybe they can make the decision depending on the individual. I mean, I know with my own family, my family are all leftists, and I have given them a copy of the book. We haven't actually discussed it yet. I don't know what their thoughts are. My brother works for the mainstream media, as it happens, and I've given him a copy, but our views are quite different. And I'm not sure what they think of it, to be honest. But as for red-pilling people who are open-minded, I'd say it is an excellent book for that. So, yes, I certainly would recommend it's a book which will certainly raise some – it'll make people think.
Yeah, it does sound like a book that is almost designed to – illuminate contradictions in the progressive worldview, and they established the status quo worldview.
Well, I think more than anything, it is just something that will raise questions for perhaps you know, more mainstream people. someone that has read Robin DiAngelo's book, for example, White Fragility, I always recommend they read Jim Goad's book, Whiteness, the Original Sin, which is a complete counterpart to that book. Now, in the same way, my book, I hope, would serve as a counterpart for people who have heard nothing but the mainstream view. I think it would certainly give them a different perspective on it.
All right. And I suppose, lastly, how can people get the book?
Well, the book's on Amazon or Book Depository. It's out as a printed book and an e-book. Not an audio book at this stage, but it's freely available at this point, as long as there are no issues. And I think you posted a link below our live stream, haven't you? So that people can easily check on that link and check it out for themselves. I've also posted in the links some sample chapters. So if they want to go to my website, you can read the first three chapters for free. And that'll certainly give a fair indication of the book.
Links here in the live chat for people. It's the link tree that does link to various retailers selling it. So, that should help people to get hold of it.
And as for my other books, they're all on Amazon, as far as I can tell. So just go to my Amazon page and, it's all there.
All right, great. Well, thanks very much. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about Conquest by Concept? Actually, you should maybe explain the title to people before we finish.
Well, okay. Well, really, the culture war is a war of ideas. And if you look at, for example, the changing demographics of the Western world, you would say that it is significantly different than they were 100 or 200 years ago. And if you look at, you know, in one sense, you could say the West has been conquered to a large degree. Now, we haven't been conquered by physical armies. We haven't been invaded. But we have been conquered by beliefs and by concepts. Concepts that we've been taught, that we've learned, and that we've ingested perhaps without analyzing them properly or critiquing them. So really, if you look at the changing Western world as it is today, we have been radically changed, not by physical force, but by concepts and by ideas. And I think if you read the book, you will know what I mean. You'll understand what I mean by that. And it's really ideas that come before events. And the culture war is all about ideas. It's all about concepts, competing versions of reality and understanding the world. So conquest by concept is sums that up as succinctly as I could think of.
All right. And then in the course of the story, that conquest is undone in the case of some of the characters.
Well, you can only change people. You can change the world one person at a time, I think, and you can't change everyone at once, but if you can change the mind of one person, and then the world is different. So yeah, one person at a time, and that's all you can do, really.
Yeah. Okay. Well. All right. I hope that this leads to some people buying your book, and I hope that it does well. It does seem like the kind of thing that this is why I asked that. It might be something that people want to get for their friends. It's a shame we didn't do this before Christmas, because maybe some people could have got last-minute stocking fillers for their progressive friends. But obviously, yes, that would have to be done carefully.
Well, by Christmas 2021, hopefully a lot more people will have read it. And I think it'll still have the exact same appeal and relevance in 12 months as it does now.
I'm sure it will. Well, excellent. Thank you very much, Duncan, for coming on to talk about this. And I hope that people do give it a shot.
Well, thanks, Wose. It's been great to talk to you. I've been listening to you for a few years now, and it's really great to talk to you. Quite an honour.
Oh, thank you very much. You're welcome. All right. Well, I'll be back in about an hour, and it'll be on DLive only. So please make sure you're subscribed to me on DLive, because the next two for this evening will both be on DLive. So, all right, I'll see you then. In the meantime, Duncan Smith, good luck with the book and your other writing, and thanks for appearing on Millennial 2020.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, and I'll see the rest of you in about an hour. Bye for now.